And our last case for argument, United States v. Boyce, Mr. Ravitz.
May it please the Court, Ms. Peterson, Ms. Bonamici, Mr. Boyce respectfully suggests that the district judge abused his discretion and committed reversible error when he allowed the government at Boyce's trial to play a tape recording of a call made by Individual A to a 911 dispatcher and to argue that is substantive evidence that Boyce possessed a gun in violation of federal law. I think the error has several aspects to it which I'd like to discuss. First, however, the first one would be that the judge put the burden on Mr. Boyce and his lawyers in allowing the evidence in to show why it should be excluded, why there is no basis for its admission in evidence. And I think that is not the appropriate standard. I think this Court's decision in Vargas rather places the burden on the proponent of the evidence, in this case the government, to establish grounds for its admissibility. And from there, it's somewhat easy to see why the judge, taking that lenient view in terms of the government's request to admit the evidence, I think stretched the rules, the exceptions to the hearsay rule issue here, the present sense impression and the excited utterance exception, in a way that facilitated the admissibility of the evidence. I want to focus just on two aspects of those rules. They're somewhat similar. But in this Court's cases, one of the elements is suggests that the in the case of present sense impressions, that the statement or events be substantially contemporaneous, which Judge Dow found it was in this case. However, looking at the transcript itself, which the judge didn't do at the time he ruled on the motion, and apparently did not listen to the tape recording either prior to ruling on the motion, which is consistent, I think, with motion in limine practice. But it's somewhat evident from the tape, I think, that there was a separation in time between these events. Individual A calls a dispatcher. She's calling saying, you know, my boyfriend beat me, my husband beat me. He's going crazy. There's no reference to a gun. The dispatcher presses her a little bit. Is there a weapon involved? She says, yeah, there's a weapon. She's making this call from the upstairs neighbor's house, she discloses, and has no idea at that moment where Boyce actually is, whether he's in the premises, whether he's left the premises. And I suggest that that evidence indicates that maybe these events aren't quite as contemporaneous as the judge credited them in terms of allowing this evidence in against Mr. Boyce. And the court relied on the Campbell case, but there the caller had actually perceived a shooting. The event's a little bit different in kind. You've got domestic battery where the issue of the gun comes up kind of as part and parcel of the dispatcher's questioning of individual A in this case. To the extent Judge Dow relied on Campbell to support the ruling, I think it is factually distinguishable. And if there, the caller and Campbell perceiving the shooting, certainly that's something that occurred contemporaneously. The event being reported is occurring right in front of this guy. I just saw somebody shot. It's not quite the case here. Again, I think what perhaps influenced Judge Dow's ruling was his belief that the burden was on Boyce to exclude the evidence rather than on the government to prove its admissibility. With respect to the other exception that is relied upon, the excited utterance exception, I think the key element is the element this court says is the statement relates to a startling event. Now here, I think everyone really agrees, at this point at least, the startling event was a battery, domestic battery. It was not man with gun, which is what the government, and I think its motion in limine, posited the call was really about. And I think it's an emergency 911 call, a man with a gun. That's not really what that call is about, and I think the government concedes that in their brief now. It's really a domestic battery call. Judge Dow found it was a domestic battery call, which was the position that Mr. Boyce took. And so if we assume that's the startling event, how we get from that event to what really is the money here, that is, that Boyce had a gun, seems to me a stretch that goes beyond this court's prior rulings on what is required to meet the excited utterance exception. Again, I respectfully suggest that Judge Dow, I think, was leaning towards the government because Boyce had not taken steps in his mind to exclude the evidence under any kind of theory. In my view, the error in this regard was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt in a couple of respects. First, it was exploited by the government specifically to address the defense attack on Officer Cummings. And so, in rebuttal, I think the government argued, well, you know, you don't have to take it that from Officer Cummings that he saw Boyce with a gun. You know that because Individual A told you that that's what happened. Now, interestingly, it turns out that there may be some question whether Individual A ever saw Boyce with a gun. That appeared through the probation officer's somewhat extensive interview of her prior to sentencing in the case. So there was some doubt whether she actually had seen the gun. But putting that aside, the government was able to exploit the tape and the transcript, which I could suppose be interpreted to say that Boyce, in fact, had a gun. The other piece is that, and this is a problem for Mr. Boyce, admittedly, there are three bullets in his pocket, according to the government's evidence. There's a count charging him with possession of ammunition in this case, and certainly the call in this case doesn't go to that piece of it. But I think that you have an error here that perhaps infests the entire proceeding, because the judge quite properly viewed this as collective police conduct. It was focused on Officer Cummings because he's the fellow giving chase. But, in fact, Judge Dow viewed this as collective conduct. And, of course, Boyce's theory is soft-pedaled a little bit because it's sort of a dangerous theory, is that the cops planted the gun on him and beat him up in the process. And so...
Wait, I'm sorry. You mentioned the three bullets. What does the three bullets have to do with what you're...
Well, there's another count. He was convicted of the possession of ammunition, so there was evidence that he had, post-arrest, had ammunition in his pocket. So I want to address that because I think the whole issue of the phone call doesn't go directly to that other count.
Well, but, how so? I don't follow.
Pardon me?
I don't understand. What's the connection?
Well, I think that the fact that the government was able to use that call generally to bolster the testimony of police officers in the case, specifically Cummings, but overall the collective actions of the police in the case, certainly in a case where Boyce's defense was predicated on the cops not being that credible and having an agenda for putting a gun on him, may have tipped the balance. So I think that the error with respect to the allowing the tape in not only affected the count involving the gun itself, but also affected to Boyce's detriment.
So the notion is that when the police responded to the call, they decided they were going to plant a gun on near Boyce and bullets and put bullets in his pocket. Is that it?
I think it proceeds from the notion that he was beaten up by the police. And that,
well, beaten up is separate. I don't understand. They're carrying a pistol with them and bullets, and they put the bullets in his pocket and toss the gun over the roof and so on and then pick it up.
That was Mr. Boyce's defense. And in fact, on the tossing of the gun, I mean, there's some unusual features about the chase between Cummings and Mr. Boyce. I mean, after all, you have one officer who testified that Boyce was highly intoxicated, yet he's fleeing this officer with his mangled hand, is able to take the gun with his right hand, toss it over not one but two roofs into a yard. It's something that Boyce's lawyers questioned.
With the mangled, how do we know that?
I think that appears in the pre-sentence report that Boyce has a disability in his right arm and hand.
Couldn't they have tossed it with his other hand?
According to Officer Cummings, he observed Boyce running down the alley, and in the glint of the streetlight, saw the silver barrel gun in his right hand, and he tossed it hook style over the garage, as was recovered later on. So that was Mr. Boyce's defense. If there are no further questions, I thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Ravis. Ms. Peterson?
May it please the Court, Michelle Peterson on behalf of the United States, and we appear to ask this Court to affirm the conviction and sentence of the defendant. The District Court did not abuse its discretion when it admitted the 911 call as both a present sense impression under Rule 803.1 and an excited utterance under Rule 803.2.
I don't understand the excited utterance rule. Is that some piece of, ancient lore, or is there any actual basis for thinking that excited people tell the truth?
Under this circuit's case law,
I know, but is there anything besides, a long history of judicial belief in this? Is there psychological evidence? Or?
Your Honor, I'm not sure if there's psychological evidence, but I think the common wisdom is that when your adrenaline's pumping and you're in a startling event, you don't have time to concoct a story. You're narrating things truthfully as it's happening to you, or truthfully reacting to the event, because you just simply don't have the opportunity to fabricate. And that's what makes an excited utterance more credible than a calm utterance where someone's had time to think about the answer and perhaps manipulate
the answer. But the government doesn't think, for example, that whenever they arrest a person, the person being excited and upset tells them the truth, right?
That's correct. Not everyone who's...
I don't believe in excited utterance. Yeah.
I think Your Honor's right. Sometimes it doesn't necessarily mean that the person is telling the truth. In this case, Ms. Boyce, her statement that he has a gun is corroborated by the fact that minutes later the police officers testify. They see him with a gun. They see him throw the gun.
Mangled arm point that Mr. Rivas just made.
There's a little bit of... at sentencing, the defendant argued that he had some kind of injury to his arm, but I don't believe there were any medical records or things such as that in the record to support that contention. And not only is Ms. Portis's statement about the gun corroborated by the fact that a gun was found, but it's also corroborated by the defendant's actions where he tries to coach her to lie about what she has seen, both in a letter he wrote to her and in a recorded phone call, both of which came in at trial and are in the record. Mm-hmm. And seeing no further questions,
okay.
We'd ask
Ms.
the court
Peterson.
To affirm. Thank you.
Mr. Rabbit, do you have anything further?
Just briefly, let me respond to the question Your Honor, posed regarding sort of the rationale for these rules. We cited in our brief a decision of this court in Lust v. Seeley where it's pointed out that there may be some question in the literature regarding how long it really takes somebody to concoct a story. Now, in this case, Individual A, remember, doesn't volunteer information about a gun. She's asked, does he have a weapon? And then when she's threatened with being put in jail, she says, yes, I'm positive he had a gun in this case. I guess one of the things we pointed out is the Ruiz case, which Judge Dow relied on in deciding to admit this evidence, is an unusual case in which, although decided under present sense impression, involves testimony from a police officer that turned out to be false and resulted in someone being incarcerated for a very long period of time, namely Mr. Ruiz, and subsequently the government realized that and actually indicted the officer in a different case. So is it possible to concoct something that would satisfy these rules that isn't true? I respectfully submit it is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Evans. And you were appointed, were you not?
Yes.
Well, we thank you for your efforts on behalf of your client, and we thank Ms. Peterson as well, and we will stand in recess.